Before I introduce our next speaker, I would like to remind you that this teachers conference and the previous two ITP teachers conferences are available on the ITP website. So you simply go to www.itp.ucsb.edu. You'll get to the ITP website, you click on online, and there is audio and transparencies from the talks at the previous teachers' conferences, and this teachers' conference will be available online.
Since when?
It has been, actually, for a couple of years. It's been available. Yeah. Okay, string theory is such a fast-moving field that textbooks just can't keep up. So even though our previous speaker wrote an excellent text, we have a great need for excellent review articles. Our next speaker was co-author of a comprehensive and crucial recent review of all of the recent developments that have happened in string theory. He managed to do that in addition to all of his important work furthering string theory himself. He's a professor of physics at Caltech, and it's a great pleasure to introduce Hiroshi Iguri.
So it is really a great pleasure for me to talk here in front of teachers from all over the United States. Well, 20-some years ago, when I was a junior high school student in a small town in Japan, there was a mathematics teacher who really showed me that there is something called truth. And that really changed, had an impact on me when I was in the middle of adolescent confusion. And so I'm very much grateful for the teacher, and so it's really my honor to be able to address in front of all of you. So my assignment is to tell you about the progress of string theory since what is called the second superstring revolution. And this is a tough assignment, but I'll do my best, and you can help me by asking questions at the end. And so I want to actually tell you something quantitative as well as qualitative. And so in order to quantify it, let me introduce some idea about scale in particle physics. First of all, I have to tell you that physicists really use only one scale. So that is because there are two fundamental constants in nature, speed of light and Planck constant. Well, that will help me to say that length and time can be measured in the same unit. Now, that's not a very difficult concept to understand. We say that, well, how far is it from here to Los Angeles? And we say, well, it's about 120 miles. That's true. But we also say that, well, it takes about 2 hours to get there. And that is because we all know that on the highway, the car travels like 60 miles per hour. So therefore, 120 miles is about the same as 2 hours. Of course, that is if there is no traffic. There is traffic, it can take 4 hours. Fortunately, in nature, there is a speed which is not affected by traffic. And that is fundamental constant, that is the speed of light. And therefore, you can measure distance and the time scale by using the same unit. And so that is why length is equal to time. The 1 meter is equivalent to 3 × 10⁹ second. And another way to say it is that in physical unit, these are the dimension of length divided by time. So therefore, by using this, we can identify length and time. In quantum mechanics, there is another constant that is fundamental, that is Planck constant, that controls the strength of quantum mechanical effect. That has a dimension of energy times time. So therefore, we can measure time as an inverse of energy. And that is what I wrote here, 2 × 10⁻⁶ GeV. GeV is a fundamental unit, basic unit in particle physics, because typical things that happen in the current particle physics can be easily measured in this unit. So, for example, the standard model of particle physics that was discussed by Joe Polchinski has been tested about 100 GeV. That is a very short length scale, that is 10⁻⁸ meter. So we know physics of the universe up to this short distance, which is amazing. Now we are trying to do better. At Fermi level, which is in the Chicago suburb, that they actually have just built accelerator which can probe us to 10 to the 3 GeV, the 10 times of this. And then in a few years, in Switzerland, the CERN will operate accelerator to 10 to the 4 GeV, which is equivalent to 10 to the minus 19 meter and 10 to the minus 20 meter respectively. So we can say that these are our best microscopes. Compared to that, there are other scales in nature. Electron mass is much smaller than this, whereas the Planck mass that appeared in the other lecture is much larger. So this will help us a lot in my talk later, so let me put this over here so that I can refer to it later. Let me focus. Now, let me continue on this a little bit. So I said that electron mass is 5 times 10 to the 4 GeV. In this everyday life unit, it is 9 times 10 to the minus 13 kilogram mass. And energy can be identified because of this famous formula that is mc squared. So if we set speed of light to be a unit, then we can identify these two. I said that because of the Planck constant, these can be also converted into length scale or time scale. And that is because of the quantum mechanical effect. That in quantum mechanics, our vacuum is fluctuating in a quantum mechanical scale. At every second, the electron is created simultaneously with anti-electron. They are created and then annihilated all together in a very short time scale and in a very small length scale. And this is a length scale that is associated to this energy scale. So this is an example where we can identify length, time, energy, and mass. Now, there is another thing called Planck mass, and I want to explain that. So this is a formula that you might use in high school physics course, that the force of the gravitational force between two massive objects is controlled by this formula, and there is this Newton constant in which in the everyday life unit is measured in this unit. If we use the identification of length, times, and energy and the mass, we can convert it into the unit of energy inverse square. And that turned out to be about 10 to the 19 GeV. So that's why we say that Planck mass is about 10 to the 19 GeV, or 2 times 10 to the minus 8 kilogram. So those are the units that we are going to use in particle physics. Now, before I get to the main topic of my talk, which is what we have learned since the second superstring revolution, I'd like to expand a little bit on the issue of why it is difficult to combine quantum mechanics and general relativity a little bit in more detail, because that will touch upon some of the things that I'm going to say later. We know what classical physics is. That is that, so for example, you can with the help of classical physics, we can do the catch ball. That if this person throw a ball at given time with some velocity, then we can reasonably guess when, from which direction that the ball will come to you. And it is because there is a well-defined time evolution that given initial position and the velocity, then you can solve a Newton equation, and then we know exactly what the trajectory is like. So that is called classical physics, that there is a unique time evolution on a given classical set of variables. And from this point of view, Einstein's general relativity belongs to this category. It's much more mathematically sophisticated, but the basic idea is the same. The dynamical variable, in the previous example, the dynamical variable is the position and the velocity of this ball, is now replaced by more refined mathematical concept of geometry, three-dimensional geometry of our universe. And then if we put some weight on somewhere, then the geometry will develop However, in a very unique way, controlled by Einstein's equation motion. And so this, in this sense, the general relativity is still in the classical physics category. Now, quantum mechanics is a completely different beast that you are supposed to sum over all possible trajectory of balls going from one to the other, and you have to sum them up, so it's very confusing as this is exemplified here. So it gets much more confusing as you try to combine quantum mechanics and general relativity because you have to sum over all possible geometries. Now, but you can say that what's the problem with that? Well, it may be conceptually difficult, but we may be able to deal with it. Actually, when I was a student in Kyoto University, there was a professor who used to tell me to shut up and compute. And I'm not saying this in a derogatory way, because this is really a good advice. Because what happens is that mathematics is really resilient structure, that you can really push the boundary of your mathematics a little bit, and then it still give you a reasonable answer. So you can close your eye to the fact that that this is a very strange thing, and just try to compute that what quantum fluctuation of gravity does to you. Turns out that you get all the nonsense answer, that white noise that appear in the Brian Greene's talk. And so I want to explain to you why something like that happens. And at a practical level, namely, if you shut up and just do the computation, what happens is that renormalization fails. Now, what does it mean that renormalization fails in quantum gravity? Well, as we all know, that as, for example, explained in Joe Portinsky's talk, that physical world has hierarchy of scales, that we have atoms, and atom consists of proton and neutron, the nuclei consist of proton and neutron, and if you expand it, you have quarks. So we have a hierarchy of scales, and as you go to shorter and shorter distance, you reveal new structure. But there is very nice thing about this, that is that if we want to understand the physics of atomic atom here, then you don't have to really know the details of quarks. All the quark physics does for your atomic physics is to set you a certain number of parameters, very small set of parameters, for you to work on here. And this is what is called renormalization, that you can forget about what is happening in a shorter scale, that those are all renormalized into finite set of parameters that you can use as given. And then you can forget about quarks or neutrons or protons, and you can just work on atomic physics. That is really a blessing for scientists, because the progress can be made incremental basis. Otherwise, if we are like, for example, 300 years ago, and if we had to know about quark physics in order to decipher everything in the world, we will be completely out of luck. Because we have to build accelerator and something like that to decipher it, but to do that, we need to know all the other physics. Fortunately, the nature is set up our world so that we can make progress in the incremental way, and so that's how we have been progressing. Now, the reason that renormalization works is that there are various ways to explain why renormalization works, but suppose, for example, there is a new physics in a shorter scale, and you have, so in this way of saying it, since length is inverse of mass, having new physics in shorter scale means that there is unknown particle with very large mass. And suppose we don't know about it. Now, does it affect our life? Not very much. Because of the uncertainty principle, if there is a particle of very heavy mass, it will live only in a very short distance. So, therefore, if you don't have a resolution of small time scale, the effect of a particle having unknown particle of very high mass will not affect the trajectory of electron very much. It can, at best, it can at best change the mass of electron, which is why I said that short distance physics can set the parameter of long distance physics. But that's all it does. So this is a part of the blessing of the world, that we have renormalization, so we don't have to know the world. At the same time, we can make incremental progress. Now, the problem of trying to combine general relativity and quantum mechanics is that this renormalization fails. That it's the general relativity actually upset this hierarchical structure. The quick way to say it is that basically the scale, the length scale of the world now become a dynamical variable in nature. So you cannot really concentrate yourself on a particular scale. More specifically, for example, the gravity causes time delay. If there is a gravitational potential, depending on where you are, the time goes in a different way. This actually was observed already 40 years ago in a Jefferson Laboratory in Harvard, and this is a little bit exaggerated, but something like that happens. Now, actually, so in order to make this a little bit more dramatic, let us consider the following experiment. Suppose there is a black hole somewhere nearby, and the black hole is surrounded by so-called event horizon, and there is a singularity in here, and you're curious to know what's happening out there. But you don't really want to risk your life. So you find your best friend and convince him, why don't you just go there and look what's happening? Because also the Bob will go there for you. And in order to tell you what's happening, he promised you that I will send you an email every day. So goodbye, and Bob goes to Event Horizon, and I'll wait. You will wait for his report. Now, what happens is that Bob is a very reliable friend, so he keeps sending an email every day. That's what he thinks. But from your point of view, it's not happening that way. What happens is that for a while, you actually are receiving email every day, but gradually, you receive email once in 2 days, and once in a week, and once in a year, and once in 10 years, and then you start not receiving email at all from him. And moreover, the signal becomes weaker and weaker, and it looks like he's just sleeping near event horizon, that he doesn't really never get there. So depending on the point of view, the same physical, so this actually is what can happen, that the same thing can be seen from different person in a different way. So if you know this old movie, you may call it as Einstein's Rashomon. And so really the way that time flies is screwed up in the general relativity, and that causes a big problem with renormalization, because the way that renormalization worked is that basically even if there is a particle of very heavy mass, you won't see it in your time scale. But if you have horizon like that, you have black hole like that, then you can see, because it takes infinite time for this particle to get here to here from your perspective. So the lesson that one might draw from here is that this nice hierarchy of scales in natural world is completely upset by combining that with general relativity. So you know that. So that means that if you want to combine general relativity in quantum mechanics, you have to know the complete answer. You cannot just make an incremental progress. That unification of gravity and quantum mechanics will cross short distance frontier of physics. So you may say that we have this atom and neutron, proton and quarks. Now we have strings. Now what's next? What's the next hierarchy of scales? Well, from this lesson we can say that if we succeed, if string theory is really our answer to unifying quantum gravity, quantum mechanics and general relativity, then we won't have any more short distance frontier. That's it. We are closing the short distance frontier. Of course, we may not be getting really the complete theory of everything. There certainly will be new frontier that may show up. There could be a new frontier that could show up in a way that we would not have anticipated. We will not anticipate right now, but at least the short distance frontier in a way that I just mentioned would be closed if we succeed in unifying gravity and quantum mechanics. And that makes this whole exercise very exciting. And the string theory is really very promising, since First of all, it contains all the ingredients that are necessary to describe particle physics phenomena, the kind of mechanism that Joe Polchinski was explaining to you. So it has Jahn-Mills interaction, the interaction between glues and other Z boson, W boson that he was describing, and fermions that are necessary to describe quarks and leptons. And basically, you have there, you have that there in string theory. And moreover, it is only consistent theory of quantum gravity, we know it. And there are no other theory that does it. So that seems to be very important things to look into. And that's why we are spending some our professional career in understanding these theories. So you can ask various questions. What does string theory tell us about quantum gravity? What does string theory tell us about unification? And what is string theory is at all? Now, so the previous speakers mentioned, both discussed the last question. So let me also touch upon a little bit about this. So what is string theory? The short answer is we do not know yet, but we made much progress from 1995 in partially answering this question. So before that, we thought of a string as this kind of rubber band propagating in space, and it's, as Brian Greene described, its various excitation is supposed to describe various particles in nature. And then they interact with each other by joining and splitting, etc. But there are actually five different string theory that we knew at the time, depending on basically how to describe this vibration. But in 1995, due to the surprising work by Ed Witten and many others, that we now realize that actually these five theories are different phases of a single unified theoretical framework. This is more like a phases of water where in this temperature pressure diagram, depending on the value of pressure and temperature, you have solid or liquid or vapor. But we know that these all come from the same unifying principle, that is the physics of H2O molecule. So if you understand this, you can derive this kind of phenomena. Similarly, it was known, it became apparent that these five types of string theory, in addition to one additional one called 11-dimensional supergravities, are all some corner of a big phase space, which you may call M. Now, what we don't know is what is the analog of this H2O molecule. So if we know it, we have a complete description of this M theory, but we are still searching for it. So that is the status of a quest to answer this question of what is string theory. Now, the second question one might ask is that, well, now you say that we have the string theory successfully unified the general relativity and quantum mechanics. No, so what does it tell us about quantum gravity? There are many mysteries of quantum gravity that are around, and can string theory help us understand it? So let me describe one of the mysteries of quantum gravity. That is so-called black hole information paradox. So I said that in black hole, there is this thing called event horizon. Event horizon is very much like the horizon that you see just out there, that you don't see things happening on the other side of the horizon. And in the case of horizon, the ocean that we see, actually it is possible for you to come back from the other side of the horizon. But in this case, once things are thrown inside of the horizon, it will never come back. So let's consider the following kind of thought experiment. Suppose you have event horizon, and you suppose you throw in some books like Elegant Universe or something of that sort. And see what happened. Well, what happened is that classically nothing happens, that this book just goes into the black hole and it will never come out. But quantum mechanically, Stephen Hawking did some computation and showed that black hole actually radiate thermal radiation. So eventually, the amount of mass that book carried would be radiated away by this radiation. But radiation does not contain any information. As you know, that radiation is a situation of maximum entropy where there is no trace of information. And so book contains lots of information, and certainly the case of the Bryant book, but those are all lost into the radiation. So where the information has gone? Now, this looks like a situation which contradicts with the basic assumption of quantum mechanics. One of the important things about quantum mechanics is that time evolution happens in a very coherent way. So you don't want things to get mixed up. And in particular, the way that quantum mechanics is set up tells you that you will never lose information when you do the time evolution. So this time kind of process seems to contradict with the basic axiom of quantum mechanics. So the question is, that can string theory successfully have a framework which successfully describes quantum mechanics of black hole, or having this kind of process is inherently inconsistent with the framework of quantum mechanics, so therefore we have to modify quantum mechanics itself in order to combine with general relativity. So that was the kind of question that faced us. And it was really the B-brain that was invented by Joe Polchinski that helps us to make progress in that direction. So D-brain is an object on which open string can end. So suppose we have a theory which consists only of closed string propagating in space-time. So everywhere outside of D-brain, you have just closed string propagating, but there is a subspace in the space where you can have open string get stuck. For example, that subspace can have any dimension. So for example, you have zero brain, which is like point-like object, and then open string can just get stuck on it. Or open string which has stuck on it can come off as a closed string. Or you can have one brain, which is one-dimensionally extended D-brain. Or you can have two brain, which is really a membrane. And actually, this is where the word brain came from. So two-brain or membrane is like a sheet over here on which open string can stick on. And what he showed is that this behaves really like a black hole. Namely, in a traditional way of addressing the question of how string theory behaves near the black hole is like that if you have a black hole, if you have an object with very heavy mass, that would warp the space-time. And you have this funny space-time where the kind of funny things that I described earlier would happen. So something like that happens because we are dealing with a space-time which is warped and doing lots of funny things. And so one way to describe what happens to a closed string when you have a black hole is to just take that warped space-time and throw in string and see what happens. But Polchinski pointed out that there is an alternative way to describe the same phenomena. That is that the same process of throwing in closed string and having that get out can be described as a process where closed string coming in and get stuck on the open string on D-brain and do various interesting things and then come off. Those two are supposed to be the same phenomena. So in order to address the question about how to describe quantum mechanics, all we have to understand then is how this open string stuck on D-brain behaves quantum mechanically. So that was very important progress, because we know we have some control about how this open string behaves quantum mechanically, and therefore answer various quantum mechanical questions about black hole. One of the quantum mechanical property of black hole has to do with the number of state that quantum mechanical black hole can have. So let me remind you the notion of entropy that appear in the thermodynamical system. Suppose you have some thermodynamical system consisting of ideal monoatomic gas such as argon. We know that macroscopically, such gas, ideal gas, can be characterized by just a few macroscopic parameters. such as its volume, temperature, pressure, or the number of atoms in it. And in fact, there is this thing called the equation of state, which relates these quantities. So in this case, although there are four parameters, but there are only really three. And the rest is dependent on them. So, however, these are macroscopic parameters. This just tells you the gross feature of this thermodynamical object. And given any of these three parameters, there are many microscopic quantum mechanical states that there are. And you can estimate how many there are. And it is given by this formula. It is a quantum mechanical state, number of quantum mechanical states, so that it has h bar in it, which is a Planck constant over there. And it is some large power of energy and volume divided by the number of molecules. So this is a formula that you can derive from quantum mechanics. And entropy is basically logarithm of this quantity multiplied by some constant called the Boltzmann constant. So entropy of thermodynamical object count the number of quantum mechanical state that there are for given macroscopic parameters. Now I mentioned earlier that black hole radiates, so it behaves like a thermodynamical problem. So there are entropies to it. So black hole is characterized by mass, which according to that formula can be related to the internal energy of the black hole, and just a few parameters. Actually, it is more or less rigorously known in classical general relativity that black hole can have only very few number of parameters. It's called no-hair theorem. That there are no detailed macroscopic description parameters. There aren't really large number of macroscopic parameters for black hole. Now, Stephen Hawking has shown, as I said earlier, that in addition to this parameter, in this case mass, the black hole can also have temperature, that it can radiate thermal radiation. And in fact, the formula, there is a formula which is analogous to this formula of PV equal NKT in the case of black hole, which is the temperature is inversely proportional to the mass of the black hole. So if there is a formula like that, you can crank some of the thermodynamical formula to derive what the entropy should be. And so this is the result of the computation. So the entropy of the black hole should be like that. So that means that given the mass of black hole, there is an enormous number of quantum mechanical state associated to that black hole if you quantize black hole successfully. And so entropy is the logarithm of the number of quantum state. So therefore, if you know the entropy, you can count the number of quantum state. You can predict the number of quantum state. And the prediction is enormous. It goes like exponential of the ratio of the mass of black hole divided by Planck scale raised to the power of 2. Now, the Planck scale is given by this formula, which in the unit of kilogram is like that. The black hole that we see in astrophysical observation, such as those discovered in a binary system, weighs like 10 to the 31 kilogram. So therefore, this predicts that that black hole has this enormous number of quantum mechanical state. The question is that can string theory account for such a large number of state? And really, that I really cannot explain you how we really count them, but please trust me that in some cases there is a very controlled way to compute quantum mechanical state using this kind of picture, and amazingly reproduce this formula, or the formula that is applicable here. And so this was a really big triumph of quantum string theory, because it really have a way to address the question of whether we can quantize black hole successfully and get a result which is predicted by earlier computation by Stephen Hawking. So that's one of the things that I wanted to tell you to the question about what does string theory tell us about quantum gravity? Now, let me get on to another question. That is that what does it tell us about unification of the forces? And there are several things one might ask about unification of the forces. As I have shown in the transparency over here, the scale in which standard model is applicable is about 10 to the 3 GeV. That is the energy scale that we can reach at this moment. But Planck scale is enormously high scale. So why is it that there is such huge difference in energy scale in nature? This is rather unusual. And in physics, this is very difficult to explain small number. The number of order one we can estimate by in the back of the envelope by doing dimensional analysis of this and that. But this kind of big gap is very difficult to explain. The supersymmetry that Joe Polchinski briefly mentioned would help stabilize this kind of gap a little bit, but we still have long way to explain why there should be such a gap. Another question is that string theory is defined in 9 plus 1 dimension. There are 9 space and 1 time. Or in some M theory description, there can even be 10 space and 1 time. But we all know that we live in 3 plus 1 dimension. So what to do with this extra 6? So these are some of the questions that one might ask in this unification. Now, Brian Green explained to you that one approach to the second problem is a Kaluza-Klein mechanism, where you compactify space into a tiny tube, and you ignore this extra dimension. But one of the new ideas that came up in the last couple of years, thanks to this development, so-called second superstring revolution, is called brain world. And actually, I made a mistake in preparing transparency, really this. And so this has to do with the D-brain that I mentioned earlier. So let me review the traditional idea about compactification that was already mentioned in Brian's talk, that these extra 6 dimensions are very tiny, like this tube that he was showing. So suppose R is the circumference of this circle. So the question is that how small should it be? Well, one of the constraints that we have about the size of this extra dimension is the fact that nobody has ever seen it. So that means that if it is there, it should be small enough so that it has escaped our observation. And the best observation we have is through these accelerator experiments, because those are really our best microscope. So that will put us a bound that the best we have seen so far is short distance equivalent of 10 to the 2 GeV, 100 GeV, whose distance equivalent is 10 to the minus 18 meter. So this is as much as our microscope can go. So therefore, the compactified scale, compactification scale, has to be smaller than that. Now, this is the largest estimate that you can make. Of course, if you want to preserve other features of the theory, you may need to go a little bit further. For example, one of the striking things about particle physics that Polchinski was alluded to was the unification of the 3 forces. Strong interaction, weak interaction, and electromagnetic interaction all seems to converge into a single unified force at the energy of 10 to the 16 GeV. And that is rather striking. That's having three lines meet together at the same point is a very non-trivial thing. And so if you want to preserve that feature of the theory, then R cannot be very large, because if R is large, then there are other excitations in the theory that will spoil the kind of nice feature. So you really have to go pretty much shorter. So that's hopeless, because we have no hope of observing such short distance in the current technology. So the new idea that came up in the market in the last couple of years is called brain world. And this is an alternative to the Kaluza-Klein compactification. And in this scenario, we postulate that, well, although there are Although there are 9 spatial dimensions, but we are confined in 3-dimensional subspace of 9 dimensions. This is different from what I said from the Kaluza-Klein compactification, because in the Kaluza-Klein compactification, we are all living in 9 spatial dimensions, even though the 6 of them is just wrapped around in a very small, but we are everywhere in this 6 dimension also. But here, we are really confined in 3 dimensions. Now, it is one thing to postulate something like that, but it's the other that whether there is actually good mathematical framework to describe that. In the case of compactification, there was a really very good mathematically well-controlled scheme to describe that, and that involved the Calabi-Yau spaces, etc., that Brian was telling you about. Because of D-brain that I mentioned earlier, we now have some idea about how to realize this brain world scenario also, because those open strings are really stuck in subspace. So we may consider ourselves as consisting of open string and stuck on this subspace, which can be our 3-dimensional world. So D-brain construction really gave us a way to realize this new scenario, where we are confined in subspace and there is this large, there is an extra dimension out there. And what is striking about this new scenario is that the experimental constraint on the size of extra dimension is really not so small. In this case, the extra dimension has to be very, very small in order to escape this experimental constraint. But in the case of brain world, the extra dimension can be pretty large, like millimeter. This is very funny because if there is this big, well, big in the particle physics scale, space, extra space out there, why are we not seeing them? The reason we are not seeing them is that we are all stuck on here. And for example, the particle accelerator, for example, are also stuck on here. So really any physical experiment that we would possibly do on our world would not easily explore or probe this extra dimension, except for gravity, which propagates everywhere in this 10 dimension. So you really have to do the gravitational experiment to observe this short this extra dimension, and experimental bound on such distance is very limited. It is because the gravitational force is very weak in short distance. It is kind of difficult for us to realize or appreciate that gravitational force is very weak, because in everyday life, the gravitational force is really dominant, that we are all stuck on the Earth because of the gravitational field. But that is because there is no negative mass, in the sense that gravitational forces are universally attractive. So even though each individual gravitational force is small, but if it is gathered like in a big mass like the Earth, then it becomes really a big force. On the other hand, electromagnetic interaction has positive charge and negative charge. So if it has become a big chunk like this, they tend to cancel each other. So therefore, we don't feel electromagnetic force very much in our everyday life, except when you get some static, when you put in winter or something. So really, the gravitational force can become only appreciable in a large scale. And if you try to do some experiment involving gravity in this short distance, it's very difficult because there are other forces that are much stronger, such as electromagnetic interactions. So you have to cut out those noises in order to do this experiment, and that is why we have this bound. Now, actually, I put some asterisks here because this is the bound that comes from the direct observation of gravitational field, gravitational force, and that is actually an elaboration of the classic Cavendish-type experiment. And that is a mechanical way to measure the Newton force. So what one really does is really analog of Cavendish experiment, where you actually measure the Newtonian force and see whether it deviates in short distance. And so the bound is that for up to millimeters, there is no visible deviation from gravitational Newtonian force. And that is the reason for this bound. But actually, there are other much stronger bounds there is And that is, for example, related to this supernova observation that Joe Porkinsio was mentioning. And it happened like that. Well, actually, so I have to tell you the story because this was personally interesting to me. So around 1987, I was actually a faculty member of the University of Tokyo. And there was a physics professor who built a big observation facility about a kilometer under the earth in what used to be a zinc mine in Kamioka in Japan. And so he somehow convinced government to build a big pool of water there, like 1,000 tons or something, of water in 1 kilometer under the earth. And the reason he wanted to do was that he wanted to observe proton to decay. That was one of the things that Porkinsio was mentioning. So he had this big mass of water, and he put detector everywhere to see whether there is any chance to observe proton to decay. And so he did this experiment for many years. And he had to go to this zinc mine because he wanted to screen all other noises like cosmic rays and things like that. And nothing happened. And he was actually due to retire in 1987. And so we are preparing for some party for him. And we are thinking, what would be the birthday present for him? And then on February 23rd, which is about a month before he retired, his facility observed in 10 seconds about 17 neutrinos. And what we didn't know about that, but unknown to everybody, about 170,000 years ago, there was one star in Big Magellan Cloud which exploded. And Magellan Cloud is pretty far, so it took 170,000 years for it to travel just in time for his retirement. And his facility, which was built for proton decay, actually observed this. And so this was very significant, because the amount of neutrino that was observed in that facility was just right for the existing theory. So there was a very nice detailed theory of how the supernova should explode, and how much energy that is released. This particular supernova is about 20 times the size of the sun. And for this kind of supernova, it is known that it would emit in this short second about 1,000 times energy of that Earth, that the sun would emit in for about 4 billion years. So that's a big amount of energy. And much of that would be appear in the form of neutrino. So there is a big amount of neutrino emitted from this supernova about 170,000 years ago. And it of course came all the way to the Earth, and so there's a big space, so it is very much diluted. And moreover, neutrino is very difficult to catch. And that's why actually it comes all the way to the Earth, because otherwise it would have scattered away somewhere before. So it came to the Earth, and it came to this professor's pool, and 17 of them was trapped there. And that was just the right number. So that was amazing confirmation of the theory of a supernova. And so that was pretty exciting. But this put a very strong bound on the extra dimension. Because if there is a big extra dimension, that would mean that the energy that was released at the time of supernova can be escaped in the form of the gravitational wave to the extra dimension. And the larger the extra dimension, the more energy that can be released. And so the energy budget that was constructed by astrophysicists would be completely upset if there are too large, if the extra dimension is too large. So it turned out to give a very stringent constraint on the size of extra dimension. So it came out to be 10 to the minus 7 if there are two extra dimensions, 10 to the minus 8 meters if there are three extra dimensions. So that's why I put some footnote to here. So there is a little bit stringent constraint, but 10 to the minus 7 or 8 meters is still much, much larger than 10 to the minus 18 meters. So the message from here is that if you take this brain world scenario, the extra dimension can be pretty large, appreciably larger than the compactification scenario. So what's so interesting about it? Because it is interesting because it can be tied to another question of why the energy scale of Planck mass is so much larger than the energy scale of the standard model physics. If the Planck scale is so large, then we won't have a chance to observe interesting quantum mechanical effect and a quantum gravity effect. And that would be, of course, very disappointing. Planck energy scale is 10 to the 19 GeV, but our current technology, and more significantly the taxpayers' money, allow us to prove only up to 10 to the 4 GeV at best. The best we have is 10 to the 4 GeV at CERN. And that's very big, so that means that normally we don't have any hope of probing physics at the Planck scale. But that's not necessarily true, because the Planck scale is defined by the Newtonian force that we observe in four dimensions, 3+1 dimension. Remember that I define Planck scale as an intrinsic scale of energy coming from four-dimensional or 3+1 dimensional gravitational interaction. But this energy scale may not be the fundamental quantum gravity scale. The theory is defined in higher dimensions, and there really is a fundamental scale defined in this full higher dimensional theory that can be different from Planck scale. And in fact, there is a simple formula that you can derive that relate this true fundamental scale to the observed Planck scale depending on the number of compactified dimensions and its size. So this is a formula. And this formula does very interesting things. So this is the formula. So suppose you have Kaluza-Klein compactification, then we see that the constraint, the largest constraint we have is 10 to the minus 18 meter, because we have seen up to that scale and we have seen no extra dimensions. That translates according to this formula that fundamental scale is 10 to the 13 GeV if there is only one extra dimension. In string theory, it can have 6 extra dimensions. That goes to 10 to the 6 GeV. That is still out of the reach from our current experiment. However, if you have brain world scenario, then R can be just less than 10 to the minus 3, or a little bit tighter constraint if you use this supernova observation, but still not very much. This is replaced by 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8. That translates to the bound on the fundamental scale to, say, 300 if there are two extra dimensions, or even 1 GeV if there are 3 extra dimensions. If you use more tighter constraint on the scale, for example, for 3 extra dimensions, it gets to 1,000 GeV, which is about the energy scale that we can even observe right now. So there are situations we can imagine in string theory in which the quantum gravity effect may be just around the corner. So even though when we see this kind of number, 10 to the 19 GeV, we think that, well, this is such a huge number, and there is no hope of observing that in our lifetime. But maybe that may not be the case. So we are very much looking forward to see the result of this experiment and see if there is any sign of this extra dimension. So that's all I wanted to say today. Thank you very much.
Okay, we have time for questions. Hope we have time for questions. I'm going to turn this off. Okay, the microphone is still on the side here. If you would like to ask questions, could you please come over to the mic?
I know that people are looking for very high energy cosmic rays, and if somebody found a 10 to the 20th GeV cosmic ray, would that have any implications for the research you're doing?
That's a very, very good question. Cosmic ray can have very high energy. The problem is that there aren't so many. And so in order to really see, in particle physics experiment, not only the high energy is very important, but the other important thing is called the luminosity, or the kind of rate that you statistical rate that you can have. And another important thing is that actual energy that is involved in the reaction. So even though the cosmic ray can have very high energy, but you can estimate what is actually the relevant energy, energy that is relevant to observe short distance physics. And that turned out to be not so much, and combine that with the statistical program that we have not been had much use of cosmic ray. Cosmic ray has been very important source probe of short distance physics earlier in the 50, 40 years ago, where many actually new particles are observed in cosmic ray experiment. But right now, the accelerator physics is really a probe to short distance. But that is very, very important point.
Would you put that equation for entropy for black hole on the board?
Yes.
Yes, in that formula there is a constant. If that constant is arbitrary, we put that equal to zero, so the number of quantum states.
This constant is determined. I just missed some numerical constant that I didn't write.
Oh, okay.
So but you can derive that from here.
So that constant is a number that is existing. It's not just only.
Yeah, it's calculable number.
Okay. I have another question.
Yes.
In string theory, we have. 10 dimensions. One of them is temporal, and one at 9 of them are spatial.
Yes.
Do we have any theory that has more than one time dimension?
That's a very interesting question. That have occurred, of course, to many of us. And but actually, the interesting things about our so far what we have seen in our quest to unify. General relativity and quantum mechanics is that we have actually modified general relativity a lot, because what used to be a gravitational particle, graviton, is now blown up into fluctuation of string. And for example, Einstein's equation is very much modified in the context of string theory. But we haven't modified a single bit about the axiom of quantum mechanics. So it's kind of unfair. So we are trying to unify quantum gravity, quantum mechanics, and general relativity, and they have to compromise. Each of them has to compromise a little bit. But it turns out that we are demanding general relativity to be modified very much, and quantum mechanics, basic axiom of quantum mechanics, hasn't modified at all. And time is a very important concept in quantum gravity, quantum mechanics. It has a very distinguished role compared to the space. So general relativity. Modification of general relativity by quantum string theory has modified our concept of space very much. For example, one of the very interesting things like we have learned about our concept of geometry in string theory is mirror symmetry, which was actually explored first by Brian Greene and his collaborators. That's a very important development in string theory. So our intuition about space has been modified very much in string theory, but our concept of time hasn't changed a bit. And we might have to do it, but we don't see any sign of having to do that. Many approaches that are taken by theorists often is that we don't fix it until we need to. And so far we are not compelled to introduce one more time. That is an answer to your question.
I was wondering, what is the membrane of the D-brain made out of?
What membrane, D-brain made out? Well, actually, that's a very interesting question. One way to understand it is the D-brain is some kind of collective excitation of strings. So black hole, for example, what is black hole? Well, black hole is a solution to Einstein equation motion. So in some sense, black holes are made of condensate of gravitons. So there is a fundamental, in Einstein's theory, there is a fundamental thing called the metric tensor, which is a dynamical variable. And then black hole appear as a classical solution to that. So D-brain was first, something like D-brain was first actually postulated by actually Gary Horowitz and his collaborators, I believe, as a solution of this type. And then Polchinski actually gave a microscopic description of that in this way. So one way to think of it is actually D-brains are made of string, but this is a more practical way to describe it. So there are many objects in physics which have various different descriptions depending on the situation. And so in some situation, this object is most easily be described by open string stuck on it. But there, in some other situations, it can be described as some kind of condensate of closed string. And actually, but because of this D-brain and the appearance of this many objects, we became some kind of, it confused what is really the fundamental thing. Is this, because in some certain situation, you can describe closed string as a bound state of D0 brain. So right now, there is some kind of democratic uprising taking place that we thought originally that closed string is more fundamental and D-brains are derived the concept. But now we are discovering a situation where actually D-brain of one kind or the other can be considered as basic things, and then string can be derived from that. And so this is related, of course, to the question that I raised earlier about what is H2O of the string theory, that we still don't know what the fundamental degrees of freedom. We only know the bits of pieces of it, and depending on where you are, there is a good description of that. In some situation, the closed string propagating in space is a good description. In some cases, D-brain is a good description. So actually, I gave you two answers which seems to be contradictory to each other. One, the answer is that in a case when closed string is a good description, D-brains are derived concept, and in fact can be considered as a condensate of closed string. But there are other cases which the roles are opposite. So that just means that we still don't know what most fundamental building blocks are.
We saw one model in which you have 3 + 1 dimensions moving through 6 others, and we have another view in which you have the curled up dimensions and we're in it. Are these incompatible? Can you imagine a hybrid? Can you carry curled up dimensions through another one?
Sure. So, yeah, actually, the picture I gave is too simplistic, that I drew just as if the space that the brain, in the brain world scenario, the space that brains is located is just flat space. But this, for example, this direction in general can be very much carbon. This itself can be Calabi-Yau space. And this D-brain can be, this brain, our brain world can be wrapping on this Calabi-Yau space in a various non-trivial way. And in fact, in order to reproduce the intricacy of our real world, we will have to do that to break lots of symmetries, etc. And so there is a hybrid of that, and also there is some kind of duality that in some cases some of the compactification can be described as in terms of a dual way in this way. And so there are lots of hybrid of opportunities, and I just showed you two extremes of these many opportunities.
Yes, when you threw a book down the black hole.
Yes.
Now, my understanding of it, which is relatively limited, is that the surface area of the black hole will expand a little bit.
Thank you very much. That's true.
But is that related to the information being retrieved or being totally lost? Is there a way to retrieve the? I'm not clear. Can the information be retrieved by knowing the increase in surface area, or is that not retrievable?
One way to, in the semi-classical description that is given here, it looks like the information is lost because. The when you throw in black hole, the black hole will gain some mass and therefore expand a little bit, but eventually it will be radiated away. Now, the question is that does the black hole, when it is thrown away, in the instance when it is thrown away, thrown in, does it contain carry information or not? And I think the current understanding of black hole quantum mechanics a la D-brain seems to suggest that D-brain is in fact carrying that information, because so this is a formula for the number of quantum states. And so if the mass energy of the black hole is increased, the number of states that black hole can carry dramatically increases. So there is certainly a room where the, you can encode the information about the book that was thrown in this large excess of states that is gained by increasing the mass of the black hole. So, well, detailed mechanism has not actually been understood, and there is actually some still paradox associated to that. But one way to see it is that you throw in matter in the book in the black hole, it gains some mass, so there are lots more states out there. So you can, there is certainly a room where you can encode the information. You can put all the sentences of the elegant universe into the different number of states that you have gained in this way.
If strings can merge, and they can merge with, let's say, D brains, what are the consequences of, if a D brain is, let's say, the surface of a black hole, what are the consequences of a string merging with a D brain as far as information is gained or lost?
Right. So the string can interact with each other on the D brain as well as outside of the brain. So outside of the brain, the closed string can merge together and make a single string and then split into two. So that way, the closed strings are interacting with each other. That can also happen on D-brain. So on D-brain, the open string can attach to it, and that can be split into two pieces, or it can dissolve into D-brain. So it does all sorts of things. And actually, in order to compute the entropy like this, you really have, the reason that I couldn't show you the detail of the computation here is that you really have to control the interaction of open string here, and then do the quantum mechanical computation correctly, taking into account the interaction, and then derive the number of states. And so really the kind of effect that you mentioned is taken into account in this kind of computation, plays a very important role there.
What's the nature of the force that binds the open-ended string to the D-brain, or in fact binds, allows a string to close on itself?
Yeah, so that's another interesting question. I have prepared a transparency that partially answers that question. I didn't show it because this is not quite correct. But actually, I have shown this. But this is almost correct, and this will convey some of the idea behind it. But this is not quite correct, I have to disclaimer. But I did show this transparency to Jo Polchinski, and she gave me his blessing. So let me show that to you. I showed this to him, and I asked him, well, I know this is not quite right, but this is almost right, and can I show it to teachers? And then he said, well, actually, this is good enough. So let me... So why strings are attached to the D-brain? Well, one way to think about it is that you have a closed string, which is propagating in space-time, but then you want to describe black hole. The black hole has these things called the event horizon, and if you throw things into the across the event horizon, you will not be able to see it, and it will have no effect on your life. So that means that closed string comes near the black hole, and really about to go into the black hole, there is a situation where part of the closed string is outside of the horizon and the other part is inside of the horizon. But if you cannot see inside of the horizon, it looks just as if open string is stuck on the horizon. So actually, the idea of D-brain, one way to understand the idea of D-brain is basically to effectively represent the physics of event horizon by open string attached to it. Actually, there is in 80s, there was a very interesting idea by my Caltech colleague Kip Song and the collaborator called membrane paradigm, where they try to represent the classical dynamics of D-brain by some degrees of freedom residing on the horizon of the black hole. And that had a very useful application, actual application in astrophysical problems. And D-brain is in some sense the microscopic, more quantum mechanical realization of Kip Song's membrane paradigm, I think.
Question, or maybe it's a little two-part question there. If a photon falls into a black hole, gains energy, does it blue shift to get to higher energy? Do we get infinite energy at the event horizon? Don't answer that quite yet, because that's a question I don't know. What happens when a string falls in a black hole? Does it frequency increase? Do we get another particle? Is that what a higher frequency string is?
That's a very interesting question. That really depends on your point of view. The kind of Einstein's Rashomon that I mentioned here. So depending on who you are, the time flows in different way. So from one point of view, the object looks very much blue shifted. So it has very high energy, and that's partly why there can be the physics of very high energy can become relevant if you want to probe the physics near the black hole. And so it is true that depending on your point of view, the physics near the black hole seems to involve very high energy. And that is why, that was one of the points I really want to convey, that is that in order to really understand quantum gravity, you really have to know infinitely physics, which goes to infinitely high energy. And that is another reason why the description in terms of closed string propagating in the geometry described by black hole may not be appropriate in some circumstances. And deep brain's description was really derived in order to deal with this exactly the kind of problem you mentioned, namely that depending on the observer, the physics looks very, very blue shifted. So the conventional description of closed string propagating, thrown into the black hole near the, and going through near the horizon, breaks down because of that. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but so deep brain is completely different way to deal with this kind of ultraviolet problem.
I have a confusion here.
Yes.
I think of a black hole as a large cosmological object, and then but what I'm thinking on strings or membranes, I'm thinking about a very microscopic. So I'm totally confused.
Thank you very much for raising that point, because at some moment I gave an example from astrophysical black hole, but actually the kind of black hole we are discussing here is a very tiny object. And namely what happens is that, so as I said here, that the black hole radiates. But actually the amount of radiation that coming from black hole is really tiny for astrophysically large black hole. But what string theorists are interested in is what happens near the end point of this radiation. So black hole does radiation, so eventually it loses most of its energy. What happens at the very end? Does it completely disappear, or there is some remnant, or what's happening there? And that is a situation where actually the curvature becomes very strong, and the blue shift effect that you mentioned become very significant. So we really cannot deal with that in the semi-classical approach that is often used. And that is where the string theory becomes useful. So here, the kind of black hole that I'm describing is really tiny compared to the astrophysical black hole that I observed. But nevertheless, if you want to complete the theory, we have to have a way to deal with that, and that is what I was discussing here.
Okay, I think we should thank Hiroshi again.